You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Dr. Yuval Nehria has devoted his life to studying the impact of mass violence, an interest born out of his own experience when he was injured during the Yom Kippur War in Israel. In the aftermath of 9/11, Dr. Nehria was recruited to come to New York in the hope that his research might be of some benefit to a city that felt irreparably scarred. And since then, his work has generated breakthrough brain research and helped to determine the best course of treatment for those still suffering from the effects of 9/11. Yuval Nehria is a professor of clinical psychology and director of the Trauma and PTSD program at Columbia University, and he's featured in WNYC reporter Marianne McCune's documentary, Living 9/11. I'm very pleased that he could join us on our show today. Hello.
Hey, good to be here.
Where were you on 9/11?
I was in Israel, actually, preparing for the academic year of 2002.
And how soon after that did you decide to leave Israel and come here?
About 2 years after 9/11, you know, my family was still here. We just finished a sabbatical in New York and preparing to go back to Israel. But, you know, I felt that the most, important thing that I can do is going back.
And now you're a professor at Columbia. So are you planning to go back?
Well, not in the near future, I would say.
You were studying post-traumatic stress disorder and other mental health conditions in response to violence before you came to New York. Did you see certain unique opportunities to study the effects of 9/11 here rather than in Israel? Is it different?
Well, I thought it's very different. In Israel, I studied war veterans particularly and also prisoners of war. This is a unique population of people who are at risk for trauma and PTSD. In New York, you know, the massive attack of 9/11 opened, you know, new opportunities to study civilians and civilians with long-term PTSD.
But Israel does have similar situations. If you're if you survive a suicide bombing on a bus, for example, isn't it kind of similar?
There are similarities. You know, terrorist events are terrorist events all over, and they usually come by surprise, and they usually detrimental, you know, to the psychic of the person. However, the scope and the dramatic magnitude, I think, put 9/11 in a different context.
And it gave you the ability to compare pre- and post-conditions more easily, I imagine.
Right.
Have you studied the impact of other large-scale violent attacks, Oklahoma City, for example?
No, I haven't had the opportunity. I read about them a lot, and actually findings of the Oklahoma event kind of, you know, guided our preliminary investigation.
When or where does the estimate of almost 1 in 10 New Yorkers suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of 9/11, where does that come from? That's a lot. We're talking about 8 million people or so. So that's 1 in 10. That's 800,000 people.
Right. So those are initial numbers, you know, that came out in the early phases after 9/11. And they went down dramatically. In the general population, almost diminished. However, if you zoom in on specific populations, such as the bereaved, you know, the responders, first responders, especially firefighters and police, as well as low-income immigrant populations, you can see elevated risk.
So with some people, it stays for a very long time, maybe forever, and others, it dissipates?
Right. And it's actually normal to the condition. PTSD is kind of a unique syndrome, you know. At the initial phases, it's almost normal or expected. What makes it abnormal is the fact that in some people it's enduring, debilitating.
And you mentioned firefighters. 1 in 10 firefighters have PTSD. And isn't that rate increasing?
It's increasing over time, unfortunately. And it's hugely comorbid with physical illness, especially pulmonary disease and other type of disease. So that's a very kind of concerning situation.
Well, if you have pulmonary disease as a result of having breathed in all of the dust on the site, I would think that would make you depressed rather than give you PTSD. How does post-traumatic stress disorder manifest itself differently from grief or depression?
Well, post-traumatic stress disorder is a fear-related syndrome, while depression is a different type of problem, and there is a certain comorbidity between the two. But PTSD is really the inability of the brain to process, you know, fear and a response and to extinguish it over time.
Well, soldiers are trained to deal with fear, and yet we are seeing huge numbers of returning troops who have PTSD. Is the PTSD all that different from the PTSD of people who survived 9/11?
Usually not so much. I mean, you can see substantial similarities between PTSD in disaster survivors and PTSD in war veterans.
My guest is Yuval Neria, who is featured in a documentary called Living 9/11. It's special on WNYC, which will begin airing on the station on September 8th at 8 p.m. For more details about the airtimes and Dr. Neria's work, you can check out our show page at WNYC.org. You found that 4 out of 10 people who suffered a loss on 9/11 continue to experience mental health conditions. Now, that number sounds incredibly high.
Right. This is the most, concerning type of finding I ever found, I think. You know, 9/11 bereaved are really high-risk groups that deserve a lot of attention from policymakers.
And what kind of mental health issues are they facing?
Especially complicated grief that is not remitted over time and is complicated and comorbid with depression and physical illness.
One of the people in Marianne McCune's documentary is a former cop who has to sleep separately from his wife.
Yes.
Why?
Well, you know, intimate relationships are the first things to be disrupted in many of the trauma survivors. They became so haunted by nightmares and flashbacks and high anxieties. They are not able really to feel, you know, comfortable and to relate to other people.
But I would assume that over time they're not having as many flashbacks. But does the new arrangement just become the norm for them?
Well, they feel more comfortable when they are by themselves. They can devote enough energy really to talk to themselves, you know. And also they are very fearful, you know, to harm other people if they feel, you know, rage and violence.
Is his a common response?
Being detached from other people is a hallmark of PTSD. Yeah.
Could you take us through some of the brain imaging that you do to study people suffering from PTSD and similar conditions?
Well, this is a fascinating topic. I was recently funded by the National Institute of Mental Health to carry out a unique project in which we learn about the differences between resilient people, those who didn't develop PTSD following trauma, to those who developed PTSD over trauma, and to compare them using functional MRI, which get us a nice window into the brain functioning.
So when you do an MRI of somebody who has PTSD, mm-hmm. can you spot the real differences right away?
In a very clear way, you know, especially when we compare them to those who didn't develop PTSD, what we basically see is the inability of the brain to process fear extinction in an effective way. They cannot extinguish, you know, fear memories and the anxiety that is related to those memories.
So there's a part of the brain that expresses fear?
Yeah.
Does that become enlarged?
No, the amygdala is becoming very, very central to the process and kind of overwhelming other parts of the brain, you know, with their inputs.
But when these people are treated, does it change again?
Right. So in our project, we are the first to look at the effect of treatment, and in this case, it's talk therapy, on the brain. And the question is whether good treatment can reverse, you know, this extinction deficit in the brain. And we have some early promising evidence to see that.
Is this something that came out of your 9/11 research? How much had you already learned from your research in Israel?
Well, you know, it takes time. You know, we didn't have the technology then. You know, we didn't have functional MRI, and we didn't have, you know, a good understanding of kind of inner brain activities. Now we are better equipped to do that, and I think the U.S. is really leading the effort in this direction.
Joseph left this comment on our show page. He said, when I was visiting Sicily, one of my grandparents passed away. Posters were placed around town to announce the wake, to tell everyone in the town about the event and announce the date and location in public. And my question is, are there other customs from other countries we can learn from as ways of dealing with death?
Right. So, you know, first of all, it's interesting to distinguish between dealing with death and dealing with fear. You know, those are probably two different, you know, type of events. Both of them can be very traumatic.
So we're less likely to see PTSD in family members, more likely to see it in people who were in the building or who had to deal with the aftermath of cleaning up the mess.
Exactly. Those who are directly exposed, you know, to the event are more likely to develop fear-related syndromes.
I would assume that journalists would have a real problem.
Journalists are it's probably one of the highest risk for that. Yeah, that's true. And but also medics and every first responders who regularly, you know, encounter traumatic events.
My guest is Dr. Yuval Neria, who, as I have been telling you, is featured in Living 9/11, a special from WNYC, which will begin airing on the station on September 8th at 8 p.m. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Dr. Yuval Neria, a professor of clinical psychology and director of the Trauma and PTS program at Columbia University. He's featured in WNYC reporter Marianne McCune's documentary, Living 9/11, which will be broadcast on September 8th at 8 p.m. here on WNYC. And we've been talking about symptoms and diagnosis. So let's move on to the next phase. What does treatment look like for 9/11 PTSD sufferers?
Well, you know, treatment should be very focused on the trauma. This is what we learned, you know, I would say over the last 10, 20 years that, you know, rather than providing psychoanalysis or all sorts of, you know, non-directed, you know, treatment, you know, if you focused on the trauma and on the memories of the trauma, you're better equipped to help the people to deal with PTSD.
But we're talking about the talking cure being applied to discussing the trauma, or are we talking about medication and other approaches?
We can talk also about medication, but interestingly enough, different from depression, where medication are perceived to be the first-line treatment for depression, in PTSD, it's really the talking trauma, and especially a type of treatment called prolonged exposure, in which the therapist is gradually exposed the patient to the memories of the trauma over the course of the treatment, in order to to decrease, you know, the avoidance from the trauma reminders.
And how does that work? Okay, so this sounds a bit like Gestalt therapy to me. You get into the moment and then you try to get through it. Okay, so you've talked it out and you've explained why you're so fearful.
No, it's not about explanations. It's really about recalling the trauma again and again, getting to the small details, getting to all guilt feelings and usually sense of failure that trauma survivors have. You know, I didn't reach this person, didn't help this person, I didn't function all right. So it's really about covering the event itself rather than going to childhood or to the parents.
A listener left a comment on our show page saying that he was helped by yoga and acupuncture-based therapy. Are they widely used, and do you think that they might be effective?
Well, sometimes, especially relaxation is very, very helpful, and yoga is using relaxation very often. So I would say it's a good idea, but I would prefer a more direct and more active, you know, treatment.
Can we do anything to prepare people for these kinds of traumatic experiences, or is all the treatment based on what happens to the brain afterward?
No, I would say that preparation, especially training, is very, very important. If you look at
firefighters.
Exactly. Or soldiers, right? The thing is that you need to develop a very gradual, you know, training program in order not to overwhelm the brain. Once the brain is overwhelmed and a person can feel a sense of failure, you know that you are in the wrong direction. So the idea is to facilitate resilience rather than overwhelm the person with stress.
Are similar techniques being used by soldiers who have experienced PTSD?
Yes, yes. And
because it's only recently that we've even taken this seriously. I've read all sorts of statistics that even suggest that British soldiers don't experience PTSD in the same numbers that Americans do, which I thought was really interesting. Stiff upper lip.
Right. And this is so interesting because they usually, you know, there is a difference in methodologies. Here they use the same methodology, found that American soldiers have, you know, more risk for PTSD as compared to British soldiers and also as compared to Israeli soldiers. So there are things that we are not really able to understand yet.
But well, I would understand the Israeli situation because if you live in a country where it's common to have to deal with some kind of terrorist attack or a country where soldiers, everybody winds up going to the military for some time, it would be very different than this country where you have to make a decision
right.
to enter the military. Except for 9/11, we have not really had to, and Oklahoma City, we have not had to really deal with the kinds of terror that people in some countries live with every day.
That's true. But for soldiers, you know, they are dealing with wars, you know, in the 20th and 21st century routinely. I mean, the Vietnam War, Iraq, Afghanistan. So I would say that the difference probably is related to the fact that the demographic profile of the American soldier is a little bit different from this of the British soldier. Americans have elevated, you know, they are, you know, you can see a lot of low income people going to the military and ethnic populations, and those are known risk factors for PTSD, unfortunately.
Well, we have had all sorts of records of what was called shell shock in the past,
right.
And that cut across all sorts of socioeconomic lines. And shell shock affected some rather well-educated people during World War I, for example,
right.
who then wrote about it and in their own work. Is shell shock different, or have things changed over the course of the 20th to the 21st century?
I think that the clinical descriptions of shell shock from World War I and II are very similar to those of PTSD today. You don't see a lot of difference.
So you're developing techniques to prepare people for the possibility of this happening to them. How do you prepare them?
So I think that the key word is simulation. You have to try to simulate, you know, the future combat or future encounter in a way that will be perceived as doable, and people will develop, you know, high self-efficacy to deal with it.
Well, before some wars, the American training, and for some soldiers anyway, involved preparation for becoming a prisoner of war,
yes.
and dealing with potential torture. Is this all that similar?
That's exactly what I meant, yeah. And the army here, you know, is using that. The Israeli army is using that. I think the British army is using that. This is a good example in which, you know, soldiers are going into, I would say, you know, a serious simulation of future traumatic events.
We mentioned earlier that as many as 800,000 people may have suffered from PTSD. Right. How many have come to your military facility? Medical facility.
Medical facility. So our trauma and PTSD program in Colombia is very busy since 9/11. We've treated, I think, hundreds of people.
But that means that there are hundreds of thousands,
of course,
who are going untreated right now?
No. So you know, Colombia is a research program. So our treatment programs are for research. But other programs in the city are service programs, you know, in Mount Sinai and NYU, and they are doing a great job in treating PTSD patients.
If somebody's listening now and has not sought treatment but recognizes him or herself in what we've been talking about, what would you recommend?
I would recommend seeking help, you know, going online to the Trauma and PTSD program at Columbia or, you know, the centers in NYU or Mount Sinai and seeking help.
And do you see a time somewhere down the line when the great majority of the people who have suffered will be able to get past this?
Well, you know, chronic PTSD is a really debilitating and very difficult to treat, you know, if it's going beyond 5 or 10 years. Yet, you know, there is great promise with new drugs that can be used, and as I said, you know, treatment is becoming more and more effective.
Yuval Nehria is featured in Living 9/11, a special from WMIC, which will begin airing on the station on September 8th at 8 p.m. For more details about airtimes and Dr. Nehria's work, you can check out our show page at wnyc.org. Just one more thing. I have just been told something, or somebody sent me a message here. In 2009 research, Oxford University scientists found that playing Tetris after a traumatic event may help prevent flashbacks and other symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. Have you heard of that study?
Not yet. This is the first time I'm hearing about it.
I don't know. What is Tetris? Do you know what it is?
Oh, Tetris is a computer game in which you have blocks, you know, that falling down into a base.
Well, maybe this is something you should look into.
Right.
And I want to thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you.